really a joy to be here. I have to say, I feel a little bit like the South African batsman. I've been on the road for 2 weeks. I've had one free day. It's been loaded with ministry, phenomenal ministry. But if I prod forward and miss the ball a few times, it's okay. You know, I'm going to play and miss. Hopefully I won't go out like they did. But don't yawn too loudly. Don't snore too captively. Just allow me a little bit of grace. Meryl's not here. Why is Meryl not here? She's just gone back to university. So after 31 years of study, we felt that our ministry was limited. When we reached into the toolbox, we found there were some tools missing. And particularly in our work with pastors and wives, we felt that the old star way of kind of having a coffee or a lunch, lean with the right shoulder, three pats on the back, suck it up in the good South African tradition, really wasn't cutting it. We were facing situations that we were incapable of dealing with. And so Meryl's gone back to do a master's in marriage and family therapy. She's doing fabulously well. She just did a paper presented a paper on the bipolar disorder and before the class. And I'm just raving about my wife because I enjoy that. And the prof commented about everyone's except Meryl. He said that was outstanding and she got 100% for it. So I did say to her the other day, I said, you know, babe, you can get a B and graduate. And she looked at me as if I just cussed her out, you know. She got 148 out of 150 for a paper, and she lost 2 points because of grammar, and she was devastated. You know, I knew I should have read through again. I knew I should have checked it. In fact, she said, I should have got Tian, our 16-year-old son, almost 16-year-old son, to read it, she said, because he's got an eye for grammar and detail. And I just shake my head. I didn't know there was an alphabet above C. I always thought, see, as long as my parents were happy, that was a great grade. The measure was not a percentage point, but a smile. If my folks smiled, I was happy. They were happy, and we did life together. I don't want to spend too much time this morning. I'm captive by the mission of the gospel. It absorbs my every waking moment. I talk about it. I think about it. I sleep about it. I've been through two branding movements. The Invisible Church from 1976 to 1983 when we closed the Invis down and planted Glenridge. And I saw it fell down like a pack of cards. It's overrated. It's overstated. But the older I get, and I'm 56, the less enamored I am by branding. Branding is a pack of cards. Branding will not go into eternity. Men and women who are redeemed by the blood of the Lamb will go to heaven. All of the other things are simply vehicles towards a greater end. The mission is what captivates me. Every day I think of the 6 billion people on the planet. If I can be honest with you, and I really don't want to linger here, I'm traumatized when I come back to this country. For the southern tip of Africa, the weak currency believed in a gospel that could change the globe, the nations of the world. The only conversations I hear are about your church and your city, and I'm traumatized. I've just spent 4 days, 5 days in Dubai, and I look across the Middle East. We went out into the desert. And good South African tradition, all the Afrikaners in the church got built fires and the motorbikes came out. And I stood there and over there was Jordan and over there's Iraq and over there's Saudi Arabia. And there are millions of people going to hell. And I'm traumatized by that. I know people think I'm too vague and I'm not crossing T's and dotting I's. My passion, Mike and Rob went to Musraq in Jordan. And they stood at a crossroads, left to Iran, right to Iraq. And there's a Syrian refugee camp of, I think, 150,000 or something Syrian refugees. He gave us a picture of these three little kids, this dignified woman who had obviously at one time had some influence, some means, a house. And the Syrian conflict has just traumatized them. They arrived pregnant with these little kids with a little suitcase on hand, getting a UN pack of a pillow and a little thin mattress and a blanket. And ladies and gentlemen, that captivates me. I'm not into... For myself, I understand the value. I live in LA. I work with churches that are cool and sexy and hipster all the time. I'm surrounded by these guys with the big beards and the short hair and the big comb over and the fold up and the Nikes. I'm surrounded by that all the time and I love it and I must have their adventure as I'm having mine. But that's not the story. The story only has meaning if it's defined by the mission. And the mission is that every man, woman and child across the planet has many opportunities to hear the wonderful name of Jesus. And if that isn't what captivates us, I'm afraid our dream is too insipid and maybe too self-preoccupied. That's my passion. I don't want to apologize for it, but you need to understand where I come from. why I do what I do and why I leave my kids and why I leave the church. And I'm back in a church plant situation, 45 people in Pasadena, back in the trenches, working in the what the LA Times calls the front line of urban evolution in Los Angeles. In the 60s and 70s, white flight emptied a little pocket called Highland Park of its white community. There's a handful of them left. The Latinos moved in, predominantly Mexicans and El Salvadorians, and the gangs and the drugs came into that area, and it's what one of the newspapers called the Forgotten City. You know Pasadena, you know Hollywood, you know Culver City, you know Santa Monica, but no one knows of Highland Park. And God in his mesmerizing beauty never has forgotten people. He always remembers them. There are empty church buildings, and Meryl and I have been invited back in to a group of 45, and we plonked in the middle of this Latin community. But here's the good news. As the PD, LAPD have come in and emptied the city of drugs and gang as much as they can. The hipsters have started moving in. The barbershops have come in. The cafes, the craft beers, the restaurants have started coming in. As God plonks us in there, I'm saying, God, what are you doing? What do I know about urban dwelling? He said, I will teach you an urban forward model that will empower you to plant churches in Paris and Berlin and Copenhagen and in Lisbon, and in Rio de Janeiro. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is my passion. The organizing is there for mission. I want to talk mission. I want to dream mission. I want to pray mission. I want to multiply Ephesians 4 gifts on mission. I want to plant churches with mission at the very center of their being. And I understand I understand that mindset. I'm there. The times I think of getting on the plane again, I'm going to miss my son's 16th birthday again. And I said, boy, I won't be here for his 16th. He said, it's fine, Dad. Can we just go surfing before you go? If mission doesn't grab our hearts, something else is, and it's illicit. It's a surrogate. It's a brand. And I've been through two branding processes. I will not go through a third. If you want to have a conversation about a journey on mission, I'm all ears. If it's a conversation about branding, I will show disinterest very quickly. Because I am captivated by the billions of people on the planet who go to hell, and I don't know why. Because honestly, I don't mean to demean myself, but every day I think of the fact that I was born in Vanderbijl Park. I'm an Afrikaans kid, and I remember walking Kaalfoot on the farm. I think, why would God take someone like me and put this global thing? I don't have what it takes. I don't have the learning. I don't have the education. I don't have the knowledge. I see people who they're going to inherit millions of dollars. You know what? My old man's going to die, and he's probably going to have to pay his last dollar for the funeral. But God, this is a captivating story. It's a remarkable journey, and it's going to cost you everything. The gospel is free, but it will cost you everything. It will. It's highly sacrificial. I said to the guys up there, honestly, this is for those who want to put their garden gloves, their welding gloves in the bags. This is grassroots. It's gutsy. It's hand dirtying. It's a funny little thing. I lost my nail. And I wish I could say I was building something amazing or doing something really profound and masculine, but I wasn't. I was carrying a couch in a church plant. That's what I was doing. I was carrying it like this. We were setting up the hall, and the guy pushed me, and my thumb got jammed between the couch and the door. I wish it was more sexy. I wish I could tell you this really rad story, fighting someone off in Beirut, Lebanon, or something really cool and manly, but it wasn't. It was carrying a couch in a church plant. So there's many more parts to the story. It's the journey around that and the mission that captivates me. I'm still enamored by the 20, 30 people who are desperate enough for Jesus in a foreign city, in a foreign shore, who are crying out to God, will someone help me? Met Stavros. Stavros is a Greek. Stavros is a wild man. He's planted two churches in Athens. He works with church plants in Albania. No one wants to go to Albania. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. He arrives in a city, goes to the central well of the village. He starts talking to the people. They're so desperate. They're hungry. Pretty soon, the whole village is out there. He preaches the gospel. He plants a church. He looks at me with tears streaming down his face. Who will help me, Chris? Who will help me? I don't want smoke machines. I want helpers. People say, Savros, we'll come. We'll go to Albania. I sat with a young man recently. He said, will you help me plant a church in Al Abayna, I'm sorry. I'll think of it in just a moment. God spoke to his dad. He said, the walls for Eastern Europe are coming down. Help me, Toma. What's that? It's a small town. Not Serbia. Just north of that. Sorry, my mind is a little tired. Anyway, it was absolutely close to the gospel. So this man took his wife and his kids, and they literally went to the village next to this border. And all the people who came through the border were truck drivers. He would learn the language and share the gospel with them. And he learned truck driver, could have been Albanian, doesn't matter. He learned truck driver. When the walls came down, he went in and he started planting churches. He sent his son who grew up, his son's first language is Albanian or whatever it is. Went to America to study at university. He came back, he sat with me, gorgeous little timid, beautiful little American bride. And he said, God's called us to go back and plant a church. I looked at her, I said, are you okay with that? Beautiful, naive, Jesus-loving, sacrificial. She said, yes, I'm prepared. I said, do you know what it's like to live in another culture? She said, Chris, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure Jesus will help me. He's going back. That's what my passion is. That's what drives me. You sit with those people, they have nothing to offer. All that beats inside of their chest is that this nation that does not know the name of Jesus. Stavros goes to Lebanon. He goes to the Palestinians. He crosses the line from Israel where he works with an Arabic Christian and an Israeli Christian who both lead churches who've fallen in love with each other. And he goes and meets with them, and then he crosses into Palestine. And he goes then, he sits under the trees with Palestinian Christians. Ladies and gentlemen, that's what my juice is. It's not sexy, it's not fancy, it's not wow. It's grassroots and gutsy. And he just stood there weeping in the Arabic desert, looking at me, looking into my eyes, looking. He said, Chris, please don't promise me what you can't produce. Will you come and help me? That's my passion. That's what stirs our faith. That's what makes sense of this all. I don't want to give myself ever again to something that can fold like a pack of cards. Please hear me, brothers. There's no anger or angst in my heart. Between you and me, I'm still in contact with Mark Driscoll because when he stepped down, everyone who was hero, Mark Driscoll, suddenly, Driscoll. So interesting emailing him because there's nothing in the emails that lets anyone who's trying to hack can't find him. Everyone's bailed. I want to shout from the rooftops. God cannot shout loud enough. Do not build your ministry around a man. Do not build your ministry around a man over and over and over and over again. And we're still way too enamored by celebrityism. It's grassroots. It's collaborative. It's us, not I. It's we, not mine. It's empowering. Peter stood up on the day of Pentecost and he preached. He was captain of the moment, not captain of a movement. Then James gets up in Acts 15. He's captain of a moment, not captain of a movement. Brothers, it seems good to us in the Holy Spirit. And everyone says, James, you're the man. We will follow. You're absolutely right. Paul doesn't say, listen, guys, I'm the main apostle here. I got the biggest ministry. Peter's Jerusalem, look at me. Look at all the cities, look at all the churches I've raised up. Submits to the fact that James is obviously the man for the moment. The New Testament is far more collaborative than we South Africans want to acknowledge. We're way too enamored by the alpha male. Okay, so that's free. That's free. Those are just some thoughts and passions. And I actually don't want to talk about that in detail today because I don't want to sell anything. I just want us to be enamored by the great Missio Dei. The great mission of God. Please read David Bosch's book, Transforming Mission. You don't even have to read it all. You can read a few pages of it and it will transform your life. He died tragically in 1992, I think, in a car accident. Great loss to a pioneering voice of mission. Okay, I want to change tack entirely. Thanks, Tomo. Thanks, everyone, for being here. I'm honestly amazed. Those of you away this week, we all flew in late last night, got delayed. But I actually want to speak to your heart. If I can, I'd like to speak as a dad. I love being a dad. I honestly, Outside of being a husband, it's the thing that I love the most. You know, there's some real benefits of handing over churches. I've handed two over now, if that's the right language. Oh, can I just say this about language? Get captivated by the idea, but please be very careful of language. I love words. I love words. Words are a divine gift. The problem is we very quickly take yesterday's words to try and squeeze them in today's story. I was so intrigued when I arrived here and people said to me, so are you starting a team? I hadn't thought of that question for probably 4 or 5 years. It hadn't entered my mind. But it's so ingrained in a psyche, the language. So I had to stop for a moment and think, well, how do I answer this? Because this is very foreign to me. I think God is designing a new apostolic imagination. And I think we have to open our hearts and minds up, thrusting ourselves back into the Scriptures and letting the Scriptures feed our story and feed our journey and give us fresh language. Partly because God is creative, and I think He has fun just to give us new words. And partly because we, you know, it's a bit like you raise your toddler and you use words, and then your toddler becomes a child and you add words, and your child becomes an adolescent and you add words. And words, you have new words. That was poo-poo. You know, I don't go to my 16-year-old son and say, do you need to go poo-poo? It's like, he's going to look at me and say, Pops, whatever, dude. Whatever. He's as tall as I am. He's uber fit. I mean, I think he's good looking, of course. But you don't say, hey, Bones, you want to go and poo-poo? He's going to look. There's a new apostolic imagination that's global. It's multicultural. It's multilingual. One of the points for me of Forge Talks that we had in Dubai was hearing a man called David, and I'm sorry, I apologize. I cannot pronounce his Sri Lankan last name. And we had 4 sessions speaking about new gospel frontiers. The secular mind, Brad from San Diego spoke. Brilliant, 27-year-old. Brilliant, brilliant. Less than 2%, I think, of San Diegans go to any form of worship on a Sunday. And they've plunked themselves in Normal Heights, which is the center of urban development, the craft beer's high, high homosexual community. And Brad is just phenomenally gifted at engaging the secular mind around the gospel. We had Ndumi from Zimbabwe speak about animism and syncretism and the gospel in that context. We had, who am I missing out? I want to get back to David, but there was someone else. I'm sorry, I can't remember. But David from Sri Lanka, he was a Tamil tiger. He used to kill, I mean, they fought in the bush. Very intriguing. I mean, these young Americans were just mesmerized by this man. But he got up and he spoke about reaching Buddhists. And he read his speech, and I could not understand him. And I'm leaning in, and I'm thinking, gee, did we make a mistake? No one can benefit from it, whatever. But as I'm sitting there, the Spirit of God says to me, most of the world doesn't speak English. It was like the shaft into my bosom. I thought, God, how arrogant. And I know language is a vehicle for the gospel. I get that. But it was this reminder that we're trying to reach the 6 billion people. But it's amazing that most of them don't speak English. How have we got the form to minister to the non-English speakers? I cannot tell you what he said. But I can tell you how he said it. And it impacted me. I have more questions than answers on that piece. Now, why did I go there, Thomas? I have absolutely no idea. So what we want to do is I want to speak to you as a father. I love being a dad, second only to being a husband, as you'll see in just a moment. And I don't want to take long, and I've already taken long. But I want to minister to you, because I think pastors and wives are very poor protectors of their soul. And so under the title of How Do I Pray for Me, I want to just speak, just walk through the realities of your heart. You know, the older we get, doing this a long time, started preaching in the street when I was 18. I'm 56 now. I've seen many of my peers get really grumpy. They've lost their sense of love for Jesus and His girl. And their souls ill-protected. 89%, ladies, of American pastors, 89% of American pastors' wives wish their husband was in another employ. Almost 90% of pastors' wives hate the ministry. Now you know why Meryl's doing what she's doing. She's already had two practices ask her to come when she graduates to start a department for pastors and wives. And the university she's at said, we have no research on that grouping called pastors' wives. But they're dying. Angry, bitter, resentful, rejected, isolated, disengaged. Another little wound, about 120 away, probably 30 women, 30 wives, that's all. We fought so hard for a marital partnership, and it's gone to smoke very quickly. I couldn't do it alone, but more of that in just a moment. So I want to speak to you a little bit about how do I pray for me. So if you want to get your Bibles, please, thank you for being gracious. Thank you for listening to my passionate rave. But it helps you understand where we come from and the journey that we are on. Psalm 51. We know the text well. We've all preached from it, I'm sure. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love. According to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, I'm reading from the ESV, and in sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, you delight in truth in my inward being, and you teach me wisdom in the secret place. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let me hear joy and gladness. And let the bones that you have broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew the ever-present tense, renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence and take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of my salvation and uphold me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways. Then, when I've done that, then I can stand up and I can teach and minister because I've been with you. Then I will teach transgressors your ways and sinners will return to you. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God. O God of my salvation, and my tongue will sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips and my mouth will declare your praise. For you will not delight in sacrifice, so I would give it. You will not be pleased with burnt offering. Or I will give it. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God. You will not despise. Do good to Zion in your good pleasure. Build up the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in right sacrifices, in burnt offerings, in whole offerings. Then bulls will be offered at your altar. Then. I was asked recently by a young church planter in Southern California. He said, Chris, why do you still love the Lord and love His church after 30 years? It was quite an interesting question. I paused for a moment, and this was my answer to him. There are four reasons. The first is my marriage. I have a remarkable wife. I'm not an easy man. When I was younger, I was particularly tough. I have the bull-headed stubbornness of the Afrikaner. I grew up in a male-dominated culture. My personality roared like a lion. If I didn't get my way, I was dominant by volume. My family was that way, so... You know, when we had a family argument, the one who was loudest, longest, wind. And so it was never easy. And Meryl came from a totally different family. Another story, I don't want to go there. But what I do want to say is I'm absolutely persuaded, was it not for Meryl, I don't know if I would love Jesus or love His church. So I spoke to her this morning on the phone. She said to me, you know, this was just before we left with a smile on her face. She says, you know, I hate you. I said, why this time? And she said, for three reasons. She said, I'm not coming with you. She can't, she's at college. She said, because you're going into the desert to have a barbecue, a braai, which when you know Mike Eltringham, my dear precious mate Mike Eltringham, he is at his roughest on his couch. His couch is the place of greatest tragedy and trauma. He will not take us to the desert or eat any Middle Eastern food. So the notion of going to the desert was something we always wanted to do, never done. But thirdly, she said, because you're staying with Nick and Cutty. Whenever we go to Durban, we stay with family. I'm absolutely persuaded that one will put 1,000 to flight, two, 10,000. I'm absolutely persuaded that whatever we have achieved, we've achieved together. It's not Chris and it's not Meryl, it's us together. I'm not putting this on anyone. Please hear me. I'm answering the question, why do you still love Jesus and his bride? In the height or the depth of our lawsuit years, if you don't know the story, it doesn't matter. I took a phone call one day, and a man abused me as only angry congregants can. And I lay on the bed in the fetal position when I put the phone down, and I was beat up more than I ever imagined. And Meryl walked in, and I knew instantly she was going to say, "It's okay, babe. Don't worry." You know, she looked at me with her hands on her hips and basically said, "Who the hell do you think you are? You're better than that. How dare you lie on this bed as a defeated man? The Spirit of the living God lives in you. This is a divine assignment." And she read me the right act and she said, "You get off that bed right now." I wanted sex and I got a rebuke. I wanted to be told how amazing I am and how wonderful I am, and they must just understand me better, and then everyone would love me. And she refused to bow to sentiment, because what was needed in that moment was a rebuke, and she gave it. I'm so grateful for my wife. I'm so grateful for the partnership. I'm so grateful for her personality that's so sublimely different. As we go from church to church every Sunday somewhere in the world, Meryl's invariably the last one to leave. They kind of give her the key to lock up because she loves in ways I don't. She works the room. She cares. I'm so grateful that God complements a gifting. I have the gifting I have. She has hers. And it's an incredible collaboration, an incredible harmony. Ladies, please don't allow your kids to distract you from the great mission of God. Please. They are part of the mission. They're not the mission. Too many. I've watched. When the kids leave home, the wife is disorientated. She doesn't know where she fits in, what she does, because she's never engaged fully in a combined God story. Please hear me. I know it's hard. I know it's tough. But you know the opposite. We were just joking, and I've got to watch it because my mind is tired and I can get sidetracked. But we have a thing in our family called Team Venant. And Team Venant means that whoever's captain on the day or the moment, the rest of the team backs them. Meaning, if my son has a big exam or a big soccer thing, he's playing in a showcase soccer tournament where all the university headhunters come and recruit from. So it's a big game for him. So I'm not there, but Meryl's there, and now it's Team Tion. Everyone is rallying around Team Tion because tomorrow's his big day. But Tuesday, it's Team Meryl because she's got a big midterm paper. So it's Team Meryl. Everyone rallies around that. And it's an incredible privilege for Meryl and I to journey together. The second thing I want to say, and I don't want to belabor the point because I want to get to the text, is my kids. I'm so grateful to God. You know, Meryl and I were talking the other day. Nass, our eldest, her and her husband lead a church plant in Perth. She's an incredible girl. She is an incredible girl. When she was 6 years old, she was asked to sing lead voice in a school production. And I came home from Glenridge, and Meryl said to me, "Babe, we've got a problem. Can I talk to you?" So we went to the side, and she said, "Babe, Nass has come home from school. The performance is tonight, but she can't do it." And there was this little blonde, big brown eyes. And I looked at her and I looked at Meryl and I got down on my knees and I put her hands in her face in my hands like this. And I said, "You know, baby, I don't know if you'll ever understand what I'm about to say to you. But if I let you say no today, you will always have an out. Every time it gets too tough, you will get out. And I want to give you the gift of life. You are going to go onto the stage tonight and you're going to sing." She sang beautifully, but she's 28 now. She went with her husband as a young couple into a different city, into a different culture to go and plant a church. They've been there 5 years or whatever. She's got four kids. Everything happens in her home. She cooks about 150 meals a week, according to Mark. Whenever I go to Perth, I sit with her because I still have a date with Dad with my kids. And I look into her eyes and I say, "How are you doing, babe?" And there are times those big eyes fill up with tears and she will say, "Dad, it's been hard." They have a 2-bedroom house, 1 bathroom, 6 of them. And then she'll say this. I don't know why, maybe I'm just tired. She'll say, "Dad, Jesus is amazing.
said, "Dad is beautiful." She said, the church has given them girls. Aussies are difficult to lead. She said, "Dad, the people." She said, "Look at Josh. Look at Anna." And she'll go around the room, these eyes filled with tears because they've had the snot kicked out of them. But she'll speak with such deep love for the community. That little girl who said, "I can't, Dad," now is the big girl who says, "I can, Dad." That's why I love Jesus and his church. I don't want to boast about my kids. I just love them. And you're blinded sometimes. We live in Brea. On a Sunday morning, 35 minutes to the church plant in Pasadena. My son goes to school over here, 30, 40 minutes away. He's 15, almost 16. There's no one in the church within 4 years of him either way. He said to me the other day, "You're pretty excited about this, aren't you, Dad?" I said, "My boy, I am." He said, "That's okay with me." No one in the church is age. Not boy, not girl. So I'm crying out. I'm saying, "God, you know my boy." We're in what they call an after party, which is when you sit and they all have lunch together after church. You go to someone's house and we sit and I watch, and he's sitting there, and there's a 27-year-old there, there's a 35-year-old, there's a music producer who's 29. It's a very gifted church. And there are about six of them, all talking about Tolkien. And Tion's scrumming, he's in there. Sci-fi, Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, it's his game. My heart lights. In the car afterwards, I say, "How did you like that boy?" Because I'm very aware, there's no one within 4 years of him. He says, "You know, Dad, I love my friends. We play soccer together, we surf together. But I can never have that conversation with them. They wouldn't know what I'm talking about." It was amazing. That's why I love God and his church. Because it crosses generations. Don't overprotect your kids. Don't. The third reason why I love Jesus and his church is because of my friends. I think we've had a sentimental rather than a biblical approach to friendships. Sorry I was emotional. I don't really know why. Maybe I just am tired and need to get home. But I love my friends. But I had to learn biblical friendship because it is different from sentimental friendships. When Dana was small, she always wanted to make her friend for life. And there was one little girl that really desired to smorkel with her. It's nice to use that word in this context. And whoever... Oh, thanks. Sorry, thanks, Gabs. Why do you carry tissues? Do you also cry? Oh, thanks, Kula. Thank you. I do. I love Jesus. I love his church. I do. He's mesmerizing. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I think for the sake of time, please adjust from a sentimental grasp of friendship to a biblical grasp of friendship. What can I say about that? Ministry produces incredible loneliness unless we do the friendship thing well. We can be busy. And we think that the friends we have that we are currently functioning with, we will be friends forever with. I've handed over two churches. It's not true. The team you work with shift their allegiance very quickly. And they have to, because you're not their leader anymore. But they may not be your friends anymore either. If you don't understand that, you can get yourself all not. Please don't think those that you're currently working with are your mates for life. It may not be true. Paul and Barnabas worked together for years, and then they parted over John Mark, and the Bible never says who was right or who was wrong. It just, they parted. I thank God, and I'm going to give you just a couple of stories to illustrate it so that it's not conceptual. Terry Fichet and I met Terry when I came out the army in 1980 at the Invisible Church, Jesus People Days, and he said, "I've been looking forward to meeting you. People talk about you," but we became friends. We ran the comrades together. We'd sit together and Meryl and I just got married, and we'd sit and play our guitars and drink red wine and dream and talk and philosophize. And then we brought him into eldership and we hit heads. Rick knows this. We hit heads. But there was something deep in our psyche and our DNA that we wanted to do life with mates. Planted Terry out. Terry planted the second church in Pasadena that he's now invited us to come into. And We've sat together, the four of us, laughed and cried about the story. But this is what I said yes to. This is what I said yes to. Not my new best friend. Dana had this weakness. She was always had a broken heart because she'd go to movies, a little 8, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, go to movies with someone, and the next day they'd have a new friend and she'd come home. I can't believe it, Dad. You know, Brittany's got another friend. I said, baby, now come and sit down here. Come, so let's talk. I said, you know, baby, there are lots of levels of friendship. Let me explain it to you. There's the one night go to the movies friend. Don't make her forever. Just enjoy her one night at the movies friend. You, Brittany is your popcorn friend. That's what Brittany is. Brittany is your popcorn friend. But Katie is going to be your lifetime friend. And Katie exists because Katie and Dana grew up together. Katie's parents planted in Belo Horizonte in Brazil. And they kept in touch. Katie came back to the States, nearly died from a physical condition, and moved to Washington. And Dana was Katie's friend in Belo Horizonte. She was Dana's friend, and they were each other's bridesmaids at their weddings, and they are still in contact, and they're still friends, because we end up in life with 3 to 5 friends that carry time. Now, when I talk about friends, I talk about those. When my dad had to have his leg amputated, my brother called me and he said, "But you have to come. Pops is 81. They're taking his leg." I said, "I'm coming." Instantly, as the word got out, Terry Fouché picked up the phone. He said, $1,500 in your account covered my ticket. Rory, unbeknown, called me and he said, "Do you want to fly business class?" Instantly, I witnessed with my spirit. I said, "Rory, how can I do that? I'm going to see my dad. I don't have to be refreshed when I look at my dad." "But you can if you want to." "No, I'm joking. I didn't." But instantly there's this friendship thing that clicks in. Some years ago, God said to me, "Become Todd Proctor's friend." Todd led the largest church in town. Didn't know what he looked like. It was this random impression one day while I was praying. The church was about 6,000. I knew he was young. I knew he was cool. So, going to have lunch. Chat, chat, chat. He tells me later, he goes back to the office. He says to Mike Erie, the teaching pastor, he says, "I don't know what Chris wants, because you only ever meet with a mega church guy if you want something." 2 months later, I call him again. "Hey, Proctor, come, let's go and have lunch." "Okay, let's have lunch." 8 years of friendship. Want nothing. Long story short, 3 months ago, his elders, business model, horrible American model, basically fire him. And Merrill and I are at the staff meeting, 65 staff members. We're at the staff meeting with Todd and Lisa when they announce they're leaving. Lisa walks up to me and she nestles up to me and I put my arms around her. Here's this beautiful woman, wife of a mega church owner who's just been fired. And she says, "Please take me to the car." 8 years worth of friendship for that moment. Now, Todd is like Rob Rufus. Now, not in theology. Rob, I would call 5 times, and then Glenda would call me once. And I thought all those years ago, if Robert and I are going to be friends, I have to accept that I'm the 5-to-1 phone caller. So I can get my heart all twisted and angry, or I can just say, Rob and I, we preach on the streets together in Durban. That's our reality. And you know what? We're still in touch. Why? Because we said we do a life with friends. The generic. It's not what I'm talking about. The generic is not what I'm talking about when it matters. Please, 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 please. Don't get sucked into that. You know what I do? And I say that to my kids and I say that to the churches I lead. Have a bad habit of looking over a man's shoulders, woman's shoulders. If they always have a new best friend, just put a little question mark next to their name. It tells me something. Don't know what it tells me, but I've noted it. That a man with 20 years of friendship, 30 years of friendship, given their age. Now, I'm leaning in there a little bit closer, but it's always, this is my mate. I'm like, just wait. Okay, I'm watching. So glad for the friends that I have. There aren't many in what I'm talking about here by category and grouping. But these men I know, that if I was to die today, they would look after Merrill for the rest of their lives. They would look after my kids. These men, Craig Clark, got onto a plane in Joburg and he flew to LA to be at the handover service. It wasn't even that because I don't want to be lead pastor. I'm not senior pastor. I'm co-laborer with Terry. But anyway, when Merrill and I were prayed in, he flew all the way around the world to be there and made a 2-minute prayer and flew all the way back. I said, "Craig, 20 years of friendship, that matters. that matter. It's not, it's inconvenient. Friendship transcends convenience or lack thereof. Anyway, I'm sorry, this has taken way too long. I really am sorry. I'll go through the rest quickly, Tom. Are you all right? You just smile at me. I don't know what that means. It's an incredible wife, an incredible kids, human, faltering, limiting. But my friends. The fourth reason, and that's where I want to just anchor the rest of the time, is my devotional life. Thanks, Regis. My devotional life. I am so grateful that as a young church planter at Glenridge, God arrested me in Durban. And he taught me, for me, this is just me, it's not you, but God taught me. And guys and gals, I wake up without an alarm between 4:30 and 5:30 every morning. And I have about 2 hours with the Lord that I cherish. When I'm on the road, I can't do it, I'm jet lagged and I'm busy. But boy, do I wait, do I long for when that, I never put the alarm on. It's like God said, I will wake you and I will teach you. I will teach you. And for 20 plus years now, I wake up between 4:30 and 5:30 and I'm in my Father's presence and it has sustained me. It has upheld me. My times, my heart has been broken. My soul has been butchered and it's been hard in ministry. And people I've loved and poured my life into have turned against me. That has sustained me. So quickly, just four little pieces. How do I pray for me? The first is an obvious one and it's simply this: intimacy versus function. Intimacy versus function. It's absolutely essential, dear friends, that we do not become so ministry-minded that we forget the wonder and the beauty of who our Father is, that we are seated at His presence. It's hard handing over churches. Glenridge was successful, for those of you there, handed over about 1,000 people to Rory. There was hardly a place that I went to, certainly in Durban, that someone didn't recognize me. And Glenridge and Chris was my identity. And God said, oh, this is not good. This is good. So He took Glenridge away. And He sent me to Los Angeles where no one knew me. In fact, I'd fly onto the freeways, ramp on, and the enemy would say, what are you doing here? And I wanted to go into one shopping mall where one person acknowledged me. It never came. Year in, year out. Year in, year out. Because what my Father longed for was time with His Son, not the leader of Glenridge Church. And God will go to whatever length, dear friends, to make sure that we and our church are not one identity. I've walked Todd through this now. From the leader of 6,000 in Orange County, 33 cities, there's hardly a place that Todd would go to where people wouldn't recognize him. And he said, Chris, I don't know who I am. Because I'm not Todd Proctor who leads Rock Harbor. I'm Todd Proctor who's married to Lisa. How do I pray for me that I am a man or a woman who is intimately found in my Father's presence? God is not my valet who fulfills my requests, and He's not my taskmaster who can never be satisfied. He is my Heavenly Father that desires my presence. When David said, cast me not away from your presence, I wonder if he was saying, please, Lord, please don't distance yourself from me. That's the thing I fear most. Please don't distance yourself from me. That's the thing I fear most. And a text like that stirs challenge inside of me because that's what I want to fear most. More than anything else, your presence, oh God, please don't distance yourself from me. A very dear friends, a growing friendship with a couple called Phil and Diane Comer. Phil was Luis Palau's worship leader, a great Latin American evangelist. And at the age of 50, he decided he didn't want to travel anymore. So he took two or three young guys and planted a church in Portland, Oregon. The Pacific Northwest is the most unchurched part of America. And the life and the vitality of God has started growing, growing, growing. His son, John Mark, a phenomenal Bible teacher, 34 years old. I want to try and bring him out. Try to get him this year, but he's just been on a longer vacation. Just an incredibly, humbly, gifted young man. Came into the church, started teaching, and it grew to 6,000. Which is when I met John Mark. But Diane, who's the story, again, this gorgeous woman, perfect upbringing, dad who just loved her from some means, so she just had, in the best possible sense, had everything a girl could marry. She married the youth pastor. So, I mean, her life was set. She has a kid, she has a second kid, and I think she was pregnant with a third. Forgive me if the details are marginally wrong. She goes to see the doctor because there's something wrong with her hearing. She goes, they do many tests, they come back and they say, Diane, we have really bad news for you. you are going fully and completely deaf. And she says for a year she fought God. You can't do that. I've been a good girl. I was a virgin when I got married. I married a youth pastor. I've been righteous. I've been upright. I've been kind. I've been generous. How dare you do this to me? For a year she fought God. And she said, Phil called the elders in one day and said, let's pray for Diane. And while they're praying, she says she hears the voice of her father, but she knows it's God saying, die, because that's what her father called me. Everything is going to be okay. And she knew two things instantly. Everything was going to be okay. And secondly, she was going deaf. Completely stone deaf. She said, God, my only request is that I will grow to hear the voice of my kids. Again, the exact timing, I don't remember, but she went completely deaf. She writes a blog now called Hearing Him in the Silence. Every morning she wakes up, and because she's deaf, she's not distracted at all. And she writes this blog that ministers to women all over the world because she knows how to be the daughter on the lap of a father rather than a ministry that's public and loud. Are you with me? How do I pray for me, oh God? Take not your presence from me. I'm not first a wife or a preacher or a mother or a magistrate. I think that's your cool gig. I'm not first. I'm first a daughter, a son of the Most High. Quickly, number two. True North versus Drift. Many years ago, I saw a South African movie, and it was a father calls for his 12-year-old son about, as best as I can remember the movie, to come and join him in Namibia. And so there's a pilot and this kid, and they're flying, and there's plane problems, and they crash land, and the pilot dies. And the whole movie's, and of course I was about 12 then, so a little Afrikaans boy, it was like, I'm all eyes and ears. And this kid knows that he's got to survive, and he's got to keep moving. And the whole thing is snakes, and I mean, it's very dramatic, and when you're 12, you can see yourself in it, and it's you, and all that kind of stuff. But there's a scene in the movie that really has held me captive since then, and the kind of the camera googles out. I know Google wasn't around then, but it googles out, and actually this boy, blistered, you know, exhausted, dehydrated, he's walking saying, my pastor may come home, my pastor may come home, my father will fetch me, my father. And as the camera googles out, he's walking in a big circle. And it's amazing to me, if we do not continuously orientate ourselves around true north, we will walk around our strengths or around our weaknesses. And the only way we can orientate ourselves around true north is to be absolutely certain that we are in His presence, putting our compass down. Have any of you seen the Reese Witherspoon's newest movie called Wild? Right, it's very powerful. Unfortunately, the language is a little hectic, and there's some very graphic sex scenes, which is a true story, tragically. So it's hard to motivate the movie for those reasons, but she decides, as part of her healing, her mother died of cancer, and she was traumatized by a very promiscuous, drug-driven lifestyle. So she decides to walk the Pacific Crest Line, is that what it's called? Something like that, which is to walk from the Mexican border up the west coast of America to the Canadian border. Never hiked before, knows nothing about it. And she goes and buys all the kit, gets dropped off on the Mexican border, Mexico across the street, and she starts her walk. Needless to say, there's some amazing pieces of her own wrestles and coming to terms with who she is and who she's not. But when she reaches the Sierras, the path is lost with the snow, and she loses her way, and then she has to get back as she puts her compass down and realigns herself to north. And dear friends, if we don't do that with some regularity, we're going to walk around in circles or get lost in the snow. We have to realign ourselves around true north. David says it this way, let me hear joy and gladness. Restore to me the joy of my salvation. My tongue will sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my eyes, and my mouth will declare your praise. Here's my thesis. If we are not in joy, we are not on the track. We've lost the track if we've lost our joy. 1 Thessalonians 1, we'll talk about it tomorrow morning. It says, and the gospel came to you with much suffering in the joy of the Holy Spirit. When we're on the track, joy will prevail. The moment we step off the track, grumpiness, I can't do, I'm overwhelmed, I'm exhausted, becomes our prevailing anthem. But when we're on the track, we face due north, and we're in the joy of the Lord because of the righteousness He's imparted to us, we can keep going. You with me? Two more quickly, and I'll try and be brief with them. Brokenness versus bruising. We are custodians of our soul. We simply cannot remain in the trauma of sin. We are custodians of our soul. We simply cannot remain in the trauma of sin. David said it this way, I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you and you only have I sinned. And then here comes the verse, let the bones you have broken rejoice. Brokenness versus bruising. I have to say, and many of you know me a long time, but for the last 2 years, the 7 or 5 before then were hell. I've never been in places as dark. I've never not wanted to get out of bed. I've never lain in the corner of the bathroom in a dark light, incapable of getting up, absolutely beaten to a smithereens by the work of darkness and by those who call Jesus Lord. I've never experienced such brokenness. And I think every one of us will go through it because the verse says, the bones you have broken. And when we think men have broken our bones, we haven't learned the lesson and we won't have the breakthrough. It was as I leopard crawled my way to the sanity. I do not know what men have done to me. I do not know who's at fault and who's not. But this I know according to the text, you break my bones and only you can heal them. Men will bruise me, but God will break me. There isn't a leader on this planet who does not have to wrestle with God's breaking. Are you with me? And it's always to strengthen us. Meryl was knocked over as a 12-year-old on a bicycle, and you can still feel the bump if I let you touch her leg. You would still feel the bump of her broken leg, but they say that leg's stronger than this leg. Point well taken. Quickly, let me say this. Please, please, please forgive yourself of the sins you have committed. That's why I love what David says. It's against you, O God, that I've sinned. Why does he say that? Because we can reason our sins away. I didn't mean to. It wasn't my fault. That wasn't my idea. We can reason it away. But David says, you know what, God? You determine an act evil or not. You determine it. I don't. Because I've got a lawyer's mind. I can argue my way around anything. I can convince. I've tried to convince Meryl many times. Knowing I was wrong, I thought, actually the challenge is convince. It's truth has lost its meaning right now. It's victory that matters, you know? But David says, it's against you that I've sinned. In other words, you are the definer of my sinfulness. Can I just say this, maybe to the ladies a little bit more, maybe, I'm not sure. Guilt holds so many captive. I was teaching in Long Beach at a church plant there. And I said, I'd read an article, and the article was the psychologist, regular psychologist, was saying 60% of his clients cannot find freedom from guilt. 60% of his clients. He said, if I can find a cure for guilt, I would go bankrupt. So I teach this. I don't know how, maybe it's the gospel or something. And so a man walks up to me afterwards. He says, hi, my name's whatever. I'm a Christian psychologist. I wanted to say to him, what does that mean? I thought that would probably be offensive. He says to me, Chris, most of my clients are Christian, and there are several pastors' wives in there. And he said, they want to find freedom from their guilt. The wonder of the gospel is the ability to say, the measure of evil is yours, not mine. And then I find the space of self-forgiveness. And ladies and gentlemen, we need to do it every day. I am so grateful, my God, my wife has forgiven me. I nearly fell morally in my 30s. Nearly. It was this close. It was a decision away. And Meryl has never raised that subject with me, and she knows the details. See, the wonder of the gospel is forgiveness, and the wonder of the gospel is forgetfulness. He chooses to remember my sin no more. And one of the great gifts I can give myself is to forgive myself. And so many of you ladies live under, I'm not doing enough. And let's meet this person. What about that person? And you run yourself ragged around self-imposed guilt, supposedly governing a church that actually holds you captive. Instead of finding the freedom that it's against you that I've sinned. And if I haven't sinned against you, it does not matter what men say. They can call me anything. They can accuse me of it. It does not matter because you are the measure of morality. And if you said it's okay, I'm okay with it. I was going to say something else, but I'm not. You've done fabulous well. I remember listening to Gordon MacDonald many years ago. He fell morally in ministry, and he did a Q&A with pastors in Peter Maritzburg, an American brother. And a man got up, recognized the accent and the man's ethnicity, and he said, "I don't take vacations," he said, "because what happens if I take vacations and someone dies in my church while I'm gone? What happens if I take a vacation and someone gets divorced while I'm gone?" And Gordon MacDonald, a very gentle man who'd fallen morally, had to rebuild his life, rebuild his marriage, rebuild his ministry, leaned into the man and he said, "Sir, you have a messianic complex. You think your job is Jesus' job. He will build his church. It's your job to sow, to water. It's his job to build." Ladies and gentlemen, you have taken on a great, grand assignment. It's a gift to live such sacrifice. I look around the room. Many of you are well educated with degrees that could earn much, much more money than you ever can. And there is a reward this side of heaven and that side. And there will be many a song sung with the great anthem writers in eternity about your adventures. Men down here may not do so. We may be too enamored by the celebrity to make much of them, their books, their profile. But I suspect in heaven they will be much quieter. And the great anthems of eternity will be sung around the exploits that God did through you. It's a great and grand assignment. And I'm sure in your lonely moments, there are times you think, "God, I left all of that behind to do this." And Mike, the clock's ticking now. I'm not 24 anymore. The clock's ticking. In the vulnerable moments, my mates who at college or university with me have now got millions of dollars worth of this, that, the other thing. The clock's ticking. We take the names of those who were in the Lamb's Book of Life. We present it to the King. We don't take our double-story house, our three-car garage, our three cars, our three pets, our vacation home, and there's nothing wrong with those. I have a big house. Nothing wrong with those. But we take names in the Lamb's Book of Life, and we offer them to Him as a sacrifice of a life well lived. And the Father will say, "Well done, my good and faithful servant. You've done well. Great will be the rewards of those who have sacrificed down here now for reasons beyond into eternity." But let your soul be free. Do not be held captive by the opinions of men who are fickle. Again, I land so grateful I've handed over two churches. Some of the loudest critics aren't there anymore. We're so enamored by them. The biggest givers, if we don't placate them, they'll leave. Tragedy. Let's pray together.